hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts Jacob Cazell, Jeff Chaney, and Todd Singer.
Welcome, everybody, back to another edition of the No Better Than Average podcast. This is episode 113, I believe. Is that right, fellas, 113?
Sure. You got it.
Yep, it sure is. I see that on my notes here. I am Jacob, one of your hosts. Along with me are my other co-hosts, Jeff and Todd. Jeff, how are you doing?
You know, I am doing great. How are you?
I couldn't complain. I am doing just peachy. Todd, how about you?
Hey, I'm hanging in. I get a little bit more useful every day at my new job, so.
A little bit.
Feeling better.
That's all we can ask for. And Jeff, you've been out beating the pavement, meeting the people, pressing the flesh, all that fun stuff. So hopefully a job is on your imminent horizon.
I think so.
Awesome. I'm hopeful. You will be gainfully employed again.
I am looking forward to it.
That is great.
That enthusiasm will last for at least 2 or 3 weeks.
I think consulting is in your future then. You got to razzle-dazzle them with a couple of weeks of excitement before it all tapers off to just apathy and malaise, right?
I think that sounds like a good plan.
Oh, that is fantastic. Hey, everybody, if you have a question, a comment, you want to rant about something we have said, goodness knows there is plenty to rant about, please give us a call at our call-in comment line. That number is 317-643-1212. You got to pay the dime to make the call, but you don't even have to talk to a human. You could talk to a robot and leave us a message. We will listen to that and probably put it on the air. You can subscribe to our newsletter at nobettershow.com/join. And if you want to support the show, that would be awesome. Throw us a couple of shekels at patreon.com/nobettershow. That is always greatly appreciated. I want to get into this with a quick rant because I just had a moment of fury at my technology. I was getting ready to come in and start recording the podcast thingamajig, and my lovely wife said, "Hey, come look at the TV. I don't know what this is." And I walked out, and there was a big block of text covering 75% of the TV screen. And at first it just looked like maybe an advert over something, but no, it was actually an overlay on top of the screen. And I started reading it, and it was from Vizio, and I don't remember it because I got angrier and angrier as I was reading it, and I didn't think to take a screenshot or anything, but basically they were telling me that they were opting me in to a program that they keep track of everything that flows through the TV and send it off to Vizio for non-personal processing to share and sell to third-party people. And, oh, if you want to opt out, here's a button you can click, but you really don't want to opt out. And I got a little incensed. And in reading it, it basically said that they will track anything that you watch through a connected app, anything...
Wow.
Yep. Anything? No, I've got computers for that. I don't do that on the television anymore.
So
the Netflix app, the Amazon Prime app, the Hulu, any of that stuff, they're going to keep track of that. They're going to keep track of anything you watch over the tuner broadcast. They're going to keep track of anything flowing through an HDMI interface. And they're going to apparently aggregate this, associate it with my IP address, which they say is non-personally identifying, which, no, that's actually pretty personally identifying, and share it with providers. So I click the turn this feature off button, to which nothing happened. Not a thing. It just sat there and did nothing. So I canceled out of it and went to the setup menu to try and figure out how to turn this off because it said you can turn it off in the menus. I couldn't find it anywhere. Nowhere could I find how to turn off this feature. And so we started Googling it. My wife found a page out on the internet. You actually go into reset all settings, of course, where you'd think you would go, and then you can turn this option off and opt out. So I went and did that and looked at the little privacy policy thing that they had updated. And as I scrolled through it, one of the things that caught my eye that also really upset me is any data that they can gather and associate back to your IP address, for all devices in your house, they will share with third-party people. So, and it says specifically, including smartphones, tablets, connected internet appliances, PCs, and other. They will share all of that information for targeted advertising. So that really got me angry. The fact that they made it, I've never seen this pop-up before. I've owned the TV for well over a year, never seen the pop-up. And then the fact that it didn't actually take me to turn it off, and then I had to dig for it because it's in a non-intuitive place. In doing some digging, trying to figure out what all was happening, I happened to find an article where a couple of years ago, back in 2015, the end of 2015, so not a couple of years ago, just a little over a year ago, they got into some trouble because it turned out that regardless of what you said, they still shared that information. So even if you opted out, they were still collecting and sharing the data, including, and this is from Avast, which is a maker of antivirus and anti-malware, including that none of it was traveling over HTTPS. It was all unencrypted web traffic. And they were taking binary blobs of data every 2 seconds of pixels across your screen and sending that off into the internet to these advertising marketing companies, which could be used. They were actually looking at specific pixels on your screen, which could be used to decode the content on your screen. So they were literally taking pictures of what you were watching, sections of, and shipping them off out into the internet marketers.
Every 2 seconds?
That's what it said.
And how long ago was this?
This was an article from November of 2015.
2015.
So a little over a year and a half ago.
Before they were bought by Le Echo.
Yes, it would have. So I don't know if you remember, I don't know if it was last episode or two episodes ago, I was talking about this, the project that I had built together, with my Raspberry Pi for, DNS blocking. And I went in and started looking at the IP address of my TV, and I started seeing lots and lots of requests to things that didn't look like it needed to be requested, including this, TVinteractive.tv domain, which doing some Googling turned up that is also a quasi-reputable marketing/content outfit. And my TV is making tons of connections to this domain. And I found quite a few that looked like they were tracking-type domains. And here's the power, folks, that you have. I went into my little Pi, Raspberry Pi computer, this little app, and I went and blacklisted anything that looked like it shouldn't be there, which is basically anything but Netflix. And I'm shutting that down. Really, really irritated me there, TiVo. So, yeah, I'm sure they're all doing it, but this was just the first time it was blatantly in my face. And I'm a technologist. I should know better about this stuff. I feel bad for the regular people out there that don't know and get themselves in trouble with this.
Wait, TiVo or
I'm sorry,
Vizio?
I said TiVo. Okay. I meant Vizio. My brain is not
just
braining
make
today.
Sure.
Yes, Vizio. I'm sure they all do it, Samsung and LG and all those people. But this is Vizio. And so apparently Vizio is watching you. And questionably, you may not be able to opt out of that unless you have the ability to block it yourself on your network. So yeah, really, really irritated me. Got my dander all up in an ire. Things were stuck in craws. I can say that.
Yeah, that reminds me of like those websites where if you close the ad, another ad pops
right
up. It's not good.
Hey, yeah. Just a quick update on the Volkswagen Dieselgate saga.
Yes. Are you $15,000 richer now?
I am more than $15,000 richer now. So I got it all taken care of. Easy peasy. Got the money in the bank already. And yeah, that's awesome.
Now, you know what you should do, because that's free money. You should take that to Vegas and put it on red.
It's free money.
And you just press it two or three times, and all your problems will be taken care of.
Yeah.
No?
Problems like marriage.
Hey, you know, you're always looking for a solution, and I am just trying to provide answers.
I like the way you think, for sure.
It's only a problem if it lands on black.
Which it won't do statistically, because you've got almost, but not quite, a 50-50 chance. May the odds be ever in the house's favor.
That's right. Anywho, that it was painless, easy, simple, and boy, they didn't want to let us out of that car place with
well,
a new
you
car.
Yeah. Well, we're giving you this nice big check.
While you're here with a pile of money.
You know what I thought was interesting? A couple things. First of all, we didn't get the money at the dealership. You had to put in your, you know, information for them to wire it to you and all that. And that's fine. No problem.
Sure. Because it's not coming from the dealership. It's coming from VW, right?
It's coming from VW. But what I thought was interesting, I asked them, I said, well, are you guys giving any special deals for us to stick with Volkswagen? And they said that as part of the class action settlement, they are not allowed to give any special preferential treatment.
Really?
To diesel owners. So there is no special deal for me to buy a Volkswagen. So guess what? I will not be buying a Volkswagen.
I mean,
that's your tax dollars hard at work.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I can kind of understand the idea that they don't want to turn around and let them be incentivized for their bad behavior to profit from, but that is surprising.
But you say that, but it only makes sense that they would do that to try to get people to stick with the brand.
Sure.
And they do have a $1,000 loyalty rebate right now. But that's for anybody that has a Volkswagen. It's in, so.
So no love specifically because you had to go through these headaches. Wow.
Like they said that was part of the settlement that they could not give anything like that. So I informed them that that was too bad for them because I would not be buying another Volkswagen.
Well, I'm sure that they're hearing that from quite a few people, I would think. I mean, if you know, once bitten, twice shy, why would you jump right back into bed if they're not going to give you a little juice?
All the companies are doing it. I don't know if you saw the article that Fiat Chrysler is now being investigated for their diesels. So they're all doing it. And, you know, it's unfortunate. But, you know, in the long and short of thing, we came out so well off from it that I am not complaining. And I would certainly consider getting a Volkswagen, except for the reason we bought that specific vehicle was because of the you know, fuel economy that you got, plus it had a lot of torque, and they just don't have an option out there now that fits that bill. So I mean, they don't have any hybrids, they don't have, you know, anything that gets comparable fuel economy. So, you know, we're looking going hybrid route from some other manufacturer, because, you know, that's what we're looking for. I don't know. Anyway, it was interesting.
Does Volkswagen, are they currently selling any diesel models in the United States right now?
None. Zero.
And probably no ETA on when they would be able to fix it and do that, right?
No, none.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. And I mean, there's not that many companies that even offer diesel. I mean, you've got, what, Mercedes and BMW, and I think you've got some truck options.
Yeah, I think there's a Chevy sedan, I think, that you can get.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, that you can get in diesel. But yeah, there are definitely not a lot of options. And, you know, we probably are not going to go the diesel route. We're just going to look at, you know, hybrids and and those, you know, there's some nice hybrid options out there that get, you know, pretty decent mileage. So
you still get the tax credit on those, or did that finally expire?
The tax credit hasn't been there for hybrids in a long time. Plug-ins still have tax incentives, but not hybrids.
Hmm. Yeah, I wasn't sure. I know that there for a while, even with the incentive, it was kind of still like on the bubble whether it made sense to buy the hybrid or not, unless you just wanted the efficiency or to save the planet. But I didn't know if I didn't think they were still offering the incentive.
You know what's funny is the reason my wife wants it isn't for, you know, necessarily the fuel economy, although it is. It's because she hates pumping gas. I mean, literally, that's the reason. She's like, when in the diesel with the fuel tank that it had, she had to pump gas like every 2.5 weeks.
Which, that's not bad.
No, that's a lot better than most cars. So
why haven't you guys moved to New Jersey yet?
Or Oregon, I think.
Yeah, Oregon as well. Either one.
Normally I do it for her, but anyway, that's her biggest thing.
Well, that, you know, that's funny, but I mean, that's a perfect example of, you know, letting the market decide what incentivizes people to buy those. Don't force it down people's throat. And if not having to get out of your car but twice a month to pump gas is what floats your boat, then great. That's what puts you into a hybrid.
The hybrid pricing has come down so much compared to what it was. I mean, it's still about $2,000 more expensive.
But in the long term, that's not really much.
That's not really all that much. And, you know, used to it was 5, 6, 7 grand more expensive, and that's just not the case anymore. So,
you know, and at $2,000, I assume that you would probably overcome the cost difference in, you know, fuel savings and, you know, potentially, because I know they don't really have any good plans for taxing hybrids when they're not using gas. I mean, almost all of our road taxes are fuel taxes. And, you know, so those hybrid and all electric people are skating a little bit right now. So I would think you'd come out ahead, you know, if you kept it 5, 7 years.
But, you know, I like your idea, because if I take that money from the Volkswagen and just let it ride 2 or 3 times, I'll get that Tesla.
There you go. And then you could do a review for the show. I can't see anything
wrong.
It's
a win-win-win.
I sense a plan coming together. I'll fly the drone and film you as you're power driving the Tesla in insane mode. We'll get some gorgeous footage. You can sleep on my couch when your wife kicks you out of the house.
I think the first problem we have is taking that money to Vegas and winning the money for a Tesla. I think that's step one problem, because I would go and be like, red, black. Oh.
Well, you know what you do? You just go and you put it on the field, and then you hit a 2 or a 12, and you triple your money, and you just one go. I can't see anything wrong with that.
You know what you do is you take your money, you put half on red.
And half on black.
Half on black.
And half on green.
And then you get double zero.
Do you know how to play Baccarat, Jeff?
I've watched enough James Bond movies that I think I can wing it.
I don't think you should do that with the life savings of your car. That seems like a bad idea. You know, interestingly, I know we've talked on this show a little bit about open concept office dwelling. And Todd, I know you're undergoing a current renovation, and my company keeps telling us that it's going to happen any day now. I found an interesting article this week talking basically about how all of the evidence is that open concept offices are terrible for productivity. They're awful for morale. There's almost no positive studies out there. But more importantly, I saw something that absolutely flabbergasted me in this article. And I wanted to throw this number out there. I know we've talked a little bit about the absurdity of the size of things at Facebook before in the past. And did you happen to catch this little byline in the article, Todd?
What with the how it's like the 3,000 people in the largest open concept office? I didn't crunch the numbers, but yeah.
Okay, so Facebook, I don't know if it is built yet or almost built, but Facebook has commissioned Frank Gehry, yes, the Frank Gehry, to build the largest open concept office space in the world. It's going to house 2,800 engineers. It's going to be for their engineering and development staff under one roof, one room. That one room is 10 acres of space.
10 acres.
It's a one room, 10 acre space. So I crunched the math, and 10 acres works out to 435,600 square feet. So what that is, to put it in perspectives that the average American can wrap their head around, I also did some further Googling, and I found out that the average Super Walmart, the average, is 187,000 square feet. Most of them are smaller, a few are bigger, but that's what they average. So that one room that Facebook is going to have almost 3,000 people in is going to be the size of 2.3 average Super Walmarts. One room, 3,000 people, a cacophony of ungodly proportions. I can't even get my head around what that is going to be like.
How many people are in a Super Walmart at any given time? It's probably under 3,000, right? But
I don't know. Sometimes it feels like there's 3,000 people in a Super Walmart at any given time. And the other thing which I thought was interesting, and also one of so many reasons I would not want to work at Facebook. The article that there was another article that linked to this Facebook article I read that because I guess one of or if not it may be the corporate motto for Facebook there is connecting the world, and Zuckerberg believes that because that work is not finished, their workspaces should reflect that they're not finished. And so this workspace, and I guess this whole big renovation they're doing at their Menlo Park offices, are going to intentionally be designed to look unfinished so that people aren't too comfortable. So it's going to be like a permanent state of almost nearly completed construction just to remind you that we're not done connecting the world. And oh my gosh, could you imagine how often that's going to be? One room the size of 2.5 Super Walmarts that looks unfinished with 3,000 engineers who may or may not bathe. I've been to Gen Con. That's going to be an awful, awful place to be every day.
What I think is interesting is that that's like 143 square feet per person. And you got to figure probably, 50 of that's going to go away in, hallways and bathrooms and stuff like that. But that's still almost 100 square feet per person.
That's 10 by 10.
That's a lot of space.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. If you break
that's
it down
more
that
space
way.
Space than you're going to get in your open office concept there, Chief.
That is true. We are going to be lucky to get like 3x3.
2x3. 2x3.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I was talking about this with my wife, and she said, well, you should put that in terms that people will know, like IKEAs, because IKEAs are huge. And I actually looked it up. IKEAs are not huge. I think the closest IKEA to us is Cincinnati, and it is under 100,000 square feet. So it's actually almost 5 Cincinnati IKEAs. IKEA they're building in Indianapolis is going to be one of the largest in North America.
They pack so much furniture into those.
It's deceptive.
Displays. But that's part of what they're selling, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you put this in this small place, put a bunch of tall bookshelves and whatever and have it fit and look good.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I would have guessed an IKEA was bigger because they seem bigger, but they're actually not that big. A Walmart's bigger than an IKEA.
Hold on, though. Is that including the warehouse space at the Walmart? Maybe that's why. Because, Super Walmart's going to have a significant amount of warehouse space that you don't actually see.
Okay. I don't know. You are picking apart my thought exercise. I Googled average Super Walmart and I got 187,000 square feet.
Not even a third of it is warehouse space.
Yeah, but that's still.
I mean, it's still a lot.
If it's a third,
it's not a third. It's not even close to a third.
The
warehouse space in those are not as big as you think, but they get shipments every day.
Wow, yeah. And multiple times a day.
Times a day. So they don't keep much stuff behind. Most of the stuff they have is out on shelves.
Yeah,
makes sense.
Well,
probably a lot of that stuff with the warehouse space is for returns. Returns and getting those back to the vendors.
Yeah, and with all of the technology, especially the technology that Walmart is leveraging in their supply chain, they are probably about as close to just in time as a large retailer can get. 20-some years ago, when I was in high school, I worked at an Osco drug, and that was probably a 20,000 square foot drugstore, and we had a shockingly small back room, and it always amused me because people would literally ask if there was anything in the back, and I would tell them, no, there's not. Our back room is big enough for our box compactor, a little area for reclamations, and a place to unload a truck. That's it. And they would insist without fail, you're lying. You're a lazy teenager who doesn't want to go get it from the back. Go look. And I would go and I would walk into this no fooling like 20x30 room. I would look around. I'd wait about 5 minutes. And I'd come back out and I go, I looked and I just couldn't find it. And they always, thank you so much for looking.
Played on your cell phone for a while.
Well, this was back 1993.
Played on his abacus.
Yeah, I don't think that playing on your phone was a thing that you did.
I had the bowling watch, where I could play some bowling on my watch.
Taken it way back in the day. Yeah, long, long time ago. I think I got it taken away from me in elementary school one day. My little Donkey Kong watch or something like that.
Well, back when I was a stockman at Walmart, we had a stock area that was loaded with two things and two things only. Diapers and paper towels.
That was about the only thing that we had in the back was diapers.
And paper towels.
Yep.
Yeah, because they're so bulky.
Yeah, that was my job. Like, I would get there, and I would go get a load of diapers. I'd take them out. I'd put them on the shelf. I'd go back, get another load of diapers, take them, put them on the shelf. I mean, just literally, that's all you did the whole time you were there. The whole shift. Just go to the back, get a whole load of diapers, go to the front. They'd be out. You'd put them out. Then you go to the back, and you get diapers. That's it.
Yep.
That's all I did.
Yep. We weren't quite that bad, but that was about all we had in the back room. We had diapers. That and the trash compactor.
Yeah, we had that too.
So we got some listener feedback here too. I don't remember.
Listeners?
We have listeners. Proof.
What?
Actual proof. I don't remember who had put it in the notes last week, but it was about the tiny one astronomy camera. Was that you, Jeff?
That was Todd.
Or is it Todd? Okay, I could remember.
Yeah, the listener that I was thinking of is the one that wrote us in. So I'm happy that he came through with my baiting him.
Not only did he come through, he came through in spades. John, our resident astronomy expert / astrophotographer. Would that be an astographer? He is now. He wrote and he replied and he said, the tiny one looks like a nice inexpensive camera. I definitely like the SkyMap integration. Many, many objects are visible in space but are quite large. You can't see them because they're very dim. The Andromeda Galaxy, for instance, would appear larger than the full moon. Light buckets, with quotation marks around light buckets, are what is needed, which is why many astronomers get bigger and bigger telescopes. But many times they only view at 20 to 50 times magnification. I did not know that. I assumed you pointed a telescope at the sky. You wanted like a million magnification. The other reason to stay with low magnification is atmospheric stability, especially here in Indiana. If you go much beyond 200 times magnification, you're simply magnifying distortions in the atmosphere. Think about looking across asphalt at a distant object on a hot day. Cameras are much more sensitive than the human eye, and you can set their exposure time with software processing available today. You can take repeated exposures of the same objects, run them through filters, and eliminate things like airplane trails, cosmic ray hits, meteor streaks, as well as add them together to get even more detail of dim objects. That's a technique I know macro photographers will use too, stacking photos so that you can get a deeper focus area on little teeny tiny things. Several years ago, I picked up a Mi DSi Pro. I learned a whole lot about being patient and tenacious. It required a telescope for the lens. I had to buy an accessory to reduce magnification power of the telescope. I had to focus the telescope with the camera. Then I had to align the finder with the camera, and then I had to go find the object I wanted to photograph because I was too cheap to get an electronic go-to telescope with GPS and an electronic database. Then I had to capture multiple dark frames to get the thermal baseline of the chip. Then I had to process a series of pictures. I used the GIMP, which is an open source graphics package, because I was again too cheap to buy Photoshop or Aperture. I managed to snag one nice black and white picture of the Ring Nebula M57, which he did attach, and it looked like a picture of space. It was kind of cool to think that, you know, some guy in his backyard was able to do that. I snagged a semi-decent picture of M13 and Jupiter. But then I had another evening where, after setting everything up, I could not get an object to land on the chip. After a couple of hours, I gave up, went to bed, and the camera has been in a foam padded case ever since. So the tiny
where
one
it belongs.
Camera, where just put that piece of technology
you know,
away.
You just go to NASA. They have some really pretty pictures. I'm just saying.
He did mention, I had cut it out for the sake of brevity, but he mentioned that his personal telescope now is a 16-inch telescope. That is big for the home gamer, I'm just going to say. He says, so the Tiny One camera. I have been painfully aware of the lack of bulb settings on most consumer cameras. Usually an exposure of a couple of minutes is needed to start to bring out details. Most camera chips out there will work for night sky photography, except two things. No bulb setting and no long exposure settings, and no sturdy base mounts. So this looks pretty awesome. Sensitive chip, built-in processing, calibrates thermal baselines without manually doing dark frames, and uses Google SkyMap to help find objects. Hell yes! That is a nice deal. Don't expect to get that picture of Saturn with the stock lens, though. I'd definitely be picking up an adapter, but I think I could easily get back into the photo business. Yes, I want one. So there you go. John, get one and take some pictures and then tell us how amazing it is and send us some pictures.
Look, in that short amount of time, I was able to go to the NASA image of the day, and it's way prettier than the picture that he sent, and it took me no time at all.
And it probably cost $7 billion.
But I'm okay with that. They can spend all the tax money they want on taking pretty pictures of space that I can go look at on NASA.gov.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. And the NASA picture of the day is an amazing, amazing place. So I thought that was cool. John, thank you so much for writing in with your comments on the camera. It looks really cool.
Case you're wondering, the Hubble telescope takes really good pictures.
Well, not anymore. Isn't it decommissioned while they're getting the James Webb up in place?
It is, but you know what I'm
saying. It did take really good pictures. It's an amazing bit. And what, like 20 years past its service window, something like that. They do a lot with a little. Folks, write your congressman. Tell them that NASA needs more funding. And then Linda wrote in and said, Happy New Year to all of you. I really enjoy your podcast because the three of you provide a lot of interesting material, and I like the way you all interact and have fun. Oh, if only Linda knew we all actually hate each other. Quite a few episodes. quite a few episodes ago, you mentioned...
It's funny because it's true.
You should hear what doesn't make the cut.
That's not true at all. That is not true at all.
Quite a few episodes ago, you mentioned that you use an app to rip DVDs to digital on your Mac. I, too, have hundreds of DVDs, mostly Disney, that I would like to convert to digital, preferably iTunes. I was using Handbrake, but it quit working several Mac OS versions ago. Maybe El Capitan? Question mark. Do you know how I can either get Handbrake to work or which app will work with Sierra? I would prefer a free app if possible. Thank you very much for your help. I don't know if you had done any looking on this or not, Jeff, but I did a little digging.
By the time I did, I saw what you had put in. I was using Handbrake. I hadn't tried to rip one in so long that I didn't even know that it didn't work. Yep. I just, honestly, I'm probably going to buy the one that you found called Mac X DVD Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
It's only $40, and to me, it's worth it to make backups of stuff. So, but no, I didn't realize that it has been long enough ago that I ripped all my stuff, and I haven't done it recently that, you know, I just didn't realize. Most of the new ones that I get have the free ultraviolet or mm-hmm. the Disney digital copies, so I hadn't been ripping them because I have them. And I didn't realize I, you know, was behind the eight ball on that. So yeah, but
yeah,
go ahead, tell us what else you found.
So I thought that was interesting. Something. Yeah, so I found one that Jeff mentioned, Mac X DVD Ripper, which I think their website is macxdvd.com. It looks like it's about $40 if you want to buy it. They say it works all easy peasy. I found out that apparently back in El Capitan, Apple implemented a new system called System Integrity Protection that causes it to remove one of the libraries that Handbrake relies on called libdvdcss. That's what does the decryption so you can actually rip the DVDs. So you can disable this SIP and reinstall libdvdcss and Handbrake should work again. There are also there's a package manager I found out there called Homebrew that you would have to install first that will then install libdvdcss in a way that will allow it to live and coexist peacefully with the built-in protections and I think also let Handbrake work with it. But overwhelmingly, I read disable SIP and then you can reinstall it and everything will be happy. However, I do want to point out before you do, the whole point of this system integrity protection system is to prevent malware and other unwanted modifications to system files. So proceed with caution if you want to do that. Basically, what you do is you restart your Mac. While it's starting up before OS 10 starts, you hold down Command R and keep holding it down until you see the Apple icon in the progress bar. Then you can let go of it. This boots you into recovery mode. From there, you go to the Utilities menu and open Terminal. And at the prompt, you type in CSRUTIL, all together, all lowercase, space disable, and hit Enter. The terminal should display a message that SIP was disabled, and then you can go to the Apple menu and select Restart. To re-enable it, you basically do the exact same thing above, reboot, hold down Command-R, get into recovery, go into terminal, and this time type CSRUTIL space enable, and it will turn it back on. So, you know, you may not want to do that. There is another option that could potentially be even more technically challenging depending on how deep you want to dive into this, but there is a product, I believe Oracle owns it now, and it is called VirtualBox, and it is a virtual machine software package. You can download it for free. You go to, I mean, if you just search for VirtualBox, you'll find it. I think you can get to it from Oracle's website too. You can download a Linux distribution in VirtualBox and basically run a virtual machine on your computer, install Handbrake there. That can see your DVD drive, and then you could rip the DVD inside of that virtual Linux machine and save it out. Would take some extra steps, but you wouldn't have to turn off SIP and make yourself vulnerable to whatever it might be protecting you from. That or, you know, spend $40. Looks like those are your two choices from what I could see. So there you go. Hopefully that gives you an option there, Linda.
Couple options.
Yeah.
It looks like in the notes you said that there's a free trial as well for that $40 software in case you want to try it out.
Yeah, there is a trial. You can give it a try and see if it works for you, and it's also available at their website. I don't remember if there's a limitation on like if it only rips the first 10 minutes or if it puts a watermark, but I did see that there was a free trial. And full disclosure, I have not downloaded and tried it, so I can't personally vouch for it because I did a quick accounting, and right now I don't think I own a machine that's operational that has a DVD drive on it. I mean, I've got a Mac Mini for my desktop. I've got a MacBook that doesn't have a DVD. I've got a Raspberry Pi. My Windows machine's in storage. Jeff is holding up his, I'm assuming, USB DVD drive. Yeah, I need to get me one of those. I don't have one. I mean, to be honest, I don't use physical media anymore. What is this, 2012?
I only have two within 1 foot of me right now. So
yeah, I don't have CDs anymore.
I have two within 2 feet. Look, I can reach one, and there's the other.
It's more than 2 feet. I'll give you 6 feet.
Jacob's the odd man out.
Well, I would like to think that I am the futurist because I don't have one anywhere in the room in which I am sitting. Not a single one. So anyway,
but not very practical.
I don't know. I haven't missed it so far.
What if you wanted to watch a movie right now?
I would go on Netflix or Pirate Bay or Hulu or Amazon or one of any number of places.
Yeah, like Jeff, you also typically will buy, it's like $5 more for the digital version.
Yep.
So, you know, and I just put those codes in and then go to that library and they're all there available.
Yeah. I've kind of come to the conclusion that there's so much content out there that if I can't get it in a format that suits me, I could find something else to keep myself entertained. There's almost nothing where I'm like, I have to accommodate whatever crazy scheme they have because I want to see that thing. So
yeah, we were doing some Boxing Day cleaning, and I actually hooked up a VCR and watched some VHS tapes.
Really?
Yeah, wow. Man. Blast from the past.
I don't even know that we have a working VCR. I don't even know that we have a non-working VCR in the house anymore.
We have two working VCRs. Well, and
you hold on to those.
It was kind of fun to sit there and watch some of those, you know, horribly bad kid shows that my kids watched when they were little, you know, little. And yeah.
Which are Thomas probably on YouTube at this point.
Oh, I'm sure they are, but who cares, man? There's something about popping that VHS tape in, man.
Were you kind? Did you rewind?
Of course. I still have my rewinder.
Oh, God, of course you do.
You wouldn't want to get rid of that. That could be worth something someday.
Yeah, it could. Okay, so who has the story in here about Microsoft bringing Cortana to the Android lock screen? What world do we live in?
So I put a whole bunch of quickies in. Microsoft released a overhaul of the user interface to Cortana for Android in the beta version that you can get in the Google Play Store. You can access Cortana from your lock screen with just a swipe. It does not replace your lock screen. It is a widget that you place on the lock screen, so you can use it with other lock screen apps, and you can get to Cortana directly from your lock screen without unlocking your phone.
Huh.
Why would you want to do that, I don't know, because I don't have Android, nor have I used Cortana, but by golly, it's there, and I wanted to show that I'm not all Apple biased all the time.
Microsoft has actually a pretty decent lock screen app called Picturesque. And it'll pick a random picture and put it on your lock screen. The problem that I have with it, though, is it means if you have to open it all the way up, then you're swiping twice. So if I were like using Cortana all the time on my desktop, I suppose I might consider putting that with that lock screen. But I'm not, so I'm not.
Okay. Well,
I mean, did anybody think even just 5 years ago we would be talking about SQL Server on Linux and Microsoft apps on iOS and Cortana on Android? I mean, this truly is a bizarre time we're in now.
The Microsoft apps work really well.
Yes, they do.
On Android, you know, like I've got Outlook now because I have work email on my phone, which I know people are probably cringing at, but I never had that at my old place, and it was a real pain. Everybody complained about the good app,
mm-hmm.
god.com, which apparently was a misnomer. But yeah, I've used Outlook. It was easy to install, and it works pretty well.
Yeah.
The Microsoft apps on the iPhone, iOS are excellent. So
I know you've raved about OneNote on the iPad, Jeff.
I love it. Yeah. I love OneNote on the iPad. And I mean, you know, Excel on the iPad. Yeah, those are some good apps.
A while back, I remember we had when we had Chris Spangle on. So back in the summer, I don't remember when that was.
Yeah,
back a while ago, he had mentioned on his what I love. The Microsoft had an app. It was a photography app called. Oh, I thought I had it on my phone here, but it was. It was a Microsoft photo app, and it used all sorts of intelligent processing for Microsoft Pix. That was what it was called. And I just happened to see last week that they have an app out for iOS. I'm assuming it's also available for Android, called Microsoft Selfie. And it is a dedicated selfie app that is using all of those algorithms to make it hard for you to take a bad selfie pic. It does noise reduction, so if you're in a dimly lit area, it doesn't have all the fuzzy little digital noise, and it works really well. So, I mean, Microsoft's doing some cool stuff.
It is available on Android.
Yeah.
You can't see, but it is.
You probably can't get it on Windows Phone is the ironic thing. But it's available for iOS and Android.
I don't think I take enough selfies to install it, but it is out there.
I downloaded it just because I wanted to see if it worked as well as that Microsoft Pix, and it does. If I took more selfies, which I think my wife would say that I take too many selfies, which, you know, whatever, I'm vain, get over it, then I would uninstall it. But it does work really well.
Sure. Hey, a couple other quickies that I threw in there that I wanted to make sure that I brought up. One is that CBS is going to have a new show produced and written by Andy Weir. He's about NASA.
Yeah, he's nice. The Martian guy, right?
Yeah, he is the Martian guy. He's working with the producer of The Martian, Aditya Sood. And it's going to be the story of the personal and professional life of a young team of would-be space cowboys on a daring mission.
That's cool. I'll tune in at least to see if that's any good.
I mean, at least give it a shot.
My wife and I were just talking about this, how CBS was supposed to show Star Trek on their all access, and it's still not out there.
Right.
There's clips, but there's no episodes.
Really?
So is this going to really happen, or?
Well, you know, I hope so, but, you know, you never know, really, because just because they announced
something. Is it targeted for the network itself?
It's actually targeted for the network, so.
Then it's probably coming out there.
Yeah,
I hope so.
That seems like it would have a better chance of actually materializing. Huh.
And, President-elect Trump announced that he put it, Cook's eyes are open to bringing manufacturing of iPhones to the U.S. The rumors are that Trump is going to try to push through a tax-free repatriation of foreign monies if you use it for building or creating manufacturing sites within the U.S.
Wow.
So that could be interesting if that would be some incentive for them to bring some of the European money back to the U.S. and invest it. I can't see anything bad about that.
Well, I suppose my only thing to play devil's advocate, and I hate to naysay because I would be happy if we did manufacture more in the U.S., but would we really create a lot of jobs? I would think that they would basically have five really incredibly smart people build a factory full of really incredibly complicated robots and just stand there and watch a factory churn out devices. And there would be like literally people there just to wheel pallets onto trucks. And
but that's still jobs.
It
here.
Is.
And you've got to maintain those robots. You've got to, have technicians. I mean, are there going to be people here putting together iPhones? No. Is it going to create more jobs here? Yes. So I don't have a problem with it. I think that that would be a good deal.
I agree. I know that that this will be used politically to crow about how we're bringing back manufacturing to America. And yes, but you're not bringing back jobs for workers who are, leveraging that good American skill and ingenuity and stick-to-itiveness. You're bringing back jobs for some people, but mostly robots. But,
China, in some ways, is ahead of us in automation for manufacturing. So it's probably somewhat in response to that.
Sure.
Most of the jobs we've lost are not from people moving overseas. It's from automation and manufacturing. So, I think the U.S. still leads total value output in the world of manufacturing. I think we're still the number one, manufacturing dollars, but not in Jobs. Jobs peaked in, I think, in 37 or something like that.
Oh, that long ago?
Yeah, it's...
I mean, that's... I would have guessed
Or maybe 73. I might have reversed them.
there's a big difference. One is barely post-industrial revolution. The other
one... at least 30 years ago.
I could believe that.
but no, I think some studies have indicated about 8 out of 10. It's about 8 out of 10 jobs that have been lost to automation versus offshoring.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. But, you know, I agree with you, Jeff. I don't think it's a bad thing at all. The whole tax-free repatriation is the only thing maybe that bothers me, because then, you know, well, I guess that money gets back into the economy one way or the other, because they're building, physically building things.
Yeah, they're still going to have to build them here, right?
That's true. Yeah, I mean, and someone has to, you know, build a building. Like, you those robots don't just appear. I mean, someone has to build a robot.
Absolutely.
A building has to get built. Yeah, so that would be good. That would absolutely be good.
It's going to use electricity that's going to be generated here. I mean, there's just, you know, they got to have janitors to clean it up. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff there that
it beats having it sitting in a bank in Ireland. That is for sure. That's cool. I had not heard that. I know that there had been some talks about him calling on Cook to manufacture in America. I think that was actually part of one of his campaign things over and over again. So kind of interesting that now he's saying Cook's eyes are open to it. Has Cook came out and said anything about this?
There was a picture with the article of them sitting next to each other, which to me was a huge step. So.
Well, you know, I've got Photoshop. You know, if you give me 15 or 20 minutes, I can make a picture of Trump sitting next to me. My giant hands and his tiny hands.
So those are the things for sure I wanted to talk about.
That's cool.
I had some others. We can either talk about them or not. But those are the two I thought were very interesting.
Well, I want to touch on really quickly, you've got one here, AT&T shuts down their 2G network. Really? I knew that those things were coming. I didn't know it was a done deal. So no more 2G devices out there at all, huh?
No. I took out my original iPhone. It still boots up. But at last, I cannot connect.
Huh.
Wi-Fi only.
Yep, only Wi-Fi.
And I'm impressed that you A, still have it, and B, it still boots up. I'm curious how long the battery lasts, because it's 10 years old.
The battery lasts fine. There is some dead pixels at the very top of the screen,
which makes Vizio really mad, by the way.
Yeah, no, no kidding.
And but yeah, I mean, it still works fine.
Huh. And then the other one you've got here, I had not heard this. Apparently, I have been out of the loop on Twitter news, but they have sold their developer platform to Google, so they finally found someone to buy something from them?
Yeah, they sold their Google or their developer platform to Google. The platform was called Fabric, and it's a modular mobile platform. They are planning on merging it with Google's Firebase platform.
Okay.
So that's about all I know.
Interesting.
I did see that Twitter said that they're going to maintain their current APIs that they have. So they're not shutting any APIs down. But they are no longer going to have their own platform.
That's interesting. I mean, I know that there was a lot of talk about 3 months ago back in the summer, beginning of fall, that Twitter was in trouble, and who's going to buy Twitter? And you know, it could be Google was one of the buyers. Verizon, I heard Verizon bandied about. Who else? There were a couple of really Salesforce was said to have been willing to tender an offer, which made no sense. I think maybe LinkedIn, and the whole internet was, the consensus was, Twitter is dying, Twitter's going away, and that's interesting that they've sold off their development platform.
And some people, by the way. Google bought the people that were working on that development platform as well.
So I wonder if it was more of an acquire as opposed to just buying development tools. So I would think of any company...
The development tools are going away.
Yeah.
So they're buying it for
the people,
and then they're going to roll in those APIs into their current platform and bring those people aboard.
Well, I'm just saying, if anybody has probably robust development frameworks, it's probably Google. You probably don't need help.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard
just
that.
Just another one that I had, a lot of rumors flowing from Cupertino saying that Apple is going to offer a more beefed up Kaby Lake MacBook Pro in the next quarter. that is going to have 32 gigabytes of RAM, the latest Kaby Lake processors. Some warnings that the battery life will suffer, that this may be the first time in a long time that Apple releases a piece of hardware that gets worse battery life than its predecessor. But it's supposed to be significantly faster and tout DDR4 RAM. So,
you know, but I think the people who are going to want that level of hardware are going to be willing to take the trade-off of less battery life for absurd performance. And I mean, I think that's what Apple was lambasted for with the MacBook Pro refresh this year or the last year is that it was rather anemic. I'm curious if this was their plan all along or if they got more of a backlash than they expected and are scrambling to put something out that pros actually want.
I think it was just them scrambling. Well, no, I think it was part of the plan originally. I think it was a problem with Intel not having Kaby Lake ready to roll out. And Apple finally was like, we got to roll something out now instead of waiting. And as soon as they can get Kaby Lake in mass quantities, we'll probably see a release. It probably won't be an event. It'll probably just be available now on the web, you know, on the App Store. So,
yeah,
if it doesn't have 3-4K screens, I'm not interested.
You got the bug now, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
That's the only thing bring on Valerie. Except. Yeah, I have to admit, I have not kept up on Intel's chip architecture. I'm going to have to do some reading on what all Kaby Lake brings to the party.
I think the answer to your question, Todd, is you buy 2 5K iMacs and the new MacBook Pro and plug them all together and use them.
Okay. Well, I mean, hey, DDR4, I mean, that's interesting.
You know, I'm here to tell you, I bet buying 2 5K iMacs and the MacBook Pro will be cheaper than that one laptop you're talking about and be a lot better. So I know you're not an Apple fan, but those 5K iMacs are sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, they look nice. And there's not much out there running 5K other than Apple, right? Like, it's even hard to buy those pan like that kind of a resolution in a panel.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I mean,
it's wonderful.
It's the Razer is made specifically for gaming, so it, you know, there's still, I don't know if there's games that come out for Apple or
not. My iMac plays Diablo 3 just fine, Todd.
It does not. Your load screens are weak, man. I'm always in the next level before you are. You need to get an SSD.
I'd like to point out a lot of Steam games do have the little Apple logo next to them.
Good point. Go ahead, Jeff.
I'm also not playing on the 5K iMac because if I were, I'd be playing a lot faster. I'm playing on my MacBook Pro that's driving three monitors that are it taxes it just. Well, I know why I'm slow.
Buying the 5K to run Steam games, Jacob. A lot of Steam games don't require the latest hardware.
That's true. I can't give myself over to any of those impulses, or I will be divorced and living in the Tesla that Jeff is going to buy when he's living on my couch. It would
after
be bad.
It gets red.
Yeah. It would be really bad.
Does Tesla make a camper?
Oh, we could get a camper and we could make meth, and that's how we could pay for all of the stuff.
I like the way you're thinking.
I can't see anything wrong with this plan.
I want our meth to be red, though.
We'll put chili powder in it.
There you go.
Oh,
I don't know anything about chemistry.
Well, you could Google that. That's what Google's for. Hey, Katana, Google that for me. I can do that on my Android now.
Can't we just like kidnap your wife or something? Does she know? She has to have some knowledge of chemistry, right?
Let's look up how to make meth on Jacob's Vizio.
Oh, I'm okay with that. I Google. See, if you generate enough noise in your searches, nobody can pin nothing on you. That's my motto. And I do want to throw out while we're kind of running down this rabbit hole because it made me think of Bryan Cranston. If you guys haven't, you need to go check out. I believe it is the Amazon series Sneaky Pete, which is created and produced by Cranston. It is really good. So go check that out. Awesome. I'll talk more about it, not tonight, but another time on what I love, because I haven't finished it yet, but I really like it, and I'm a big fan of Cranston.
Yeah, me too.
So I saw this article that I thought was interesting because it has me scratching my head going, how is that going to work? But a U.S. appeals court has just ruled that Apple can be sued for monopolizing iPhone's app market. So last week, a U.S. appeals court ruled that App Store customers can move forward with a lawsuit claiming that Apple has created an illegal app monopoly because it does not allow users to purchase iPhone applications outside of the App Store. So this is coming from Reuters. The decision reverses a 2013 ruling that dismissed a lawsuit originally filed in 2012. That case, which was Pepper et al. Versus Apple Inc., alleges that by not letting users purchase app from third-party sources, there was no price competition leading to higher app prices. It's a wholly owned ecosystem by Apple. I don't understand how they're going to do this. So when the lawsuit was originally filed, Apple requested it to be dismissed because developers, not Apple, sets prices for apps. Apple simply provides a platform for developers to sell apps to customers. And according to last week's ruling, the court said that because iPhone users purchase the apps directly from Apple, they have the right to file a lawsuit against the company. An attorney for the plaintiffs in the case told Reuters that the aim of the lawsuit is to allow people to shop for iPhone apps wherever they want, an outcome that's unlikely due to security implications. And if the challenge ultimately succeeds, the attorney said, quote, the obvious solution is to compel Apple to let people shop for applications wherever they want, which would open the market and lower prices. That is Mark Rifkin.
I'm going to sue Ford because I can't buy Fords at my Honda dealership.
I want a Chevy that says Mazda.
This is just the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
When you have a pile of money, people are going to sue
people
you.
People want that money.
I guess. But that's just the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard.
Right. So this attorney, Mark Rifkin, goes on to say, and this is the other part that's ludicrous to me, the other alternative is for Apple to pay people damages for the higher than competitive prices they've had to pay historically because Apple has utilized its monopoly. So doesn't that mean that Facebook then has to allow anyone to sell the Facebook app, and if someone else can sell it for a lower price, then I should be able to
lower
sue
than zero.
Well,
but Facebook gives the app away, right?
How about an app that is somebody's app that costs money? I can't think of a good example off the top of my head, but there has got to be an example. Evernote, sure. Well, that's free app too, but
it's the same price no matter. Like, my argument on that is that prices on applications that are cross-platform are not that significantly different between the Apple ecosystem and the Android ecosystem. Like, if you go and buy, Angry Birds, whatever, it's the same price on the Apple App Store as it is on the Google Play App Store. So where's the anti-competitive nature? This is just the lamest, silly lawsuit. I mean, anybody can sue, right? They're just saying right. You can sue.
Well, the court has said that the lawsuit can proceed. That's what right. the ruling is.
Yes.
So yeah. It's not been decided either way.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, just because you're suing doesn't mean you're going to win. This is just ludicrous. Like you said, Apple has a big pile of money. Somebody wants it. Congratulations, you're going to lose.
Yes,
but I'm sure Mr. Rifkin would entertain a settlement offer.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure he would as well.
Well, and of course, this ruling means now that Wolf, Hadelstein, Adler, Freeman, and Hertz is going to go forward and file lawsuits and probably try and get those lawsuits certified class action because that's where the big money for the attorneys comes in.
Right.
And it is just ludicrous.
Here, Todd, do me a favor. Pull out your handy Android phone and go to the Google Play Store and tell me how much Minecraft costs.
It's probably about $5.99. Isn't that what Minecraft is on the iOS platform?
Hold on. I just want let's do a little experiment.
Minecraft Pocket Edition is listed as $6.99.
And oddly enough, if you look on the iOS App Store, the Microsoft Pocket Edition is $6.99.
Well, I was aggrieved. Somehow somebody owes me money.
I mean, I'm willing to bet, like, I'm looking at the top 10 paid apps on the App Store. I'm willing to bet they're the exact same price in both ecosystems.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably.
Silly.
Or minuscule differences, because I think sometimes Google does, like, weird, like, $1.97 pricing.
Look up NBA 2K17, Todd.
trying to find the same list. NBA 2K.
Well, you know, and the funny thing is, though,
$7.99.
Ooh. Guess what it is on Apple's?
$7.99.
Oh, I was hoping that Google owed me some money now. But the pay for apps probably are a tiny percentage of the revenues. I mean, everything is freemium and in-app purchase now.
In the NBA 2K game, by the way, also offers in-app purchases.
After you paid eight simoleons. Wow. Do they provide the lubrication, or how does that work? Is that an in-app purchase? Oh, you want to unlock the lubrication option. That's going to be a 99-cent microtransaction. Yeah, that's great. I think, Todd, you might still have some average Android stuff that we didn't get to last time, and I know we're creeping up on an hour. Do you want to hit on some of the points that you had put in there? I am especially interested in your headline, "Want a great secure Android phone? Time for a BlackBerry?" Question mark?
BlackBerry.
Are they even still around?
They are. And what they've done now is they've turned themselves into a software company because they've contracted with TCL, okay, which is Alcatel's parent, and Alcatel releases but each year probably they make some budget phones and sell those. Mm-hmm. And they've got some good ones. And the D-Tech 60, get it? D-Tech is getting great reviews. Now, this one does not have a keyboard, a physical keyboard. This is more of a traditional smartphone. Whereas last year's Priv did, and they announced Mercury at CES that will have a keyboard, but that's not out yet. It's just a rumor. Mercury is just the project name. They don't even have an actual phone name yet. But the D-Tech 60 is a 5.5-inch 2560 by 1440 AMOLED display, and said good brightness from the reviewer. 21 megapixel rear camera does lack OIS, optical image stabilization. Has a front-facing camera that's a lot better than the Priv, so 8 megapixel versus 4. Snapdragon 820, 4 gigs of RAM, 32 internal storage, and micro SD. And a 3000 non-removable milliamp battery. Quick charge 3.0 is still on a Marshmallow at this point, but it will get the Nougat update, which is important. And you get the full BlackBerry suite of apps, if that's your thing. And if not, they're easy to disable. Not much bloatware. Now, security. It's FIPS 140-2 compliant. I don't know what that means, but if you work at an employer where that means something, that's going to be important to you. And the kernel is locked down, and as far as we know, it has yet to be hacked. And the Google Pixel, I have recently, of course, this was a little while back, but the Google Pixel was hacked not very long after it was released.
Can you get the BlackBerry suite on the non-BlackBerry branded hardware? Does it run under Android iOS?
I think so. I think I've seen that on other phones. Let me just type in here real quick BlackBerry Hub and see what comes up, because Hub is their software. Yep, BlackBerry Hub.
So that is available. So that's not the sole selling point. I'm guessing it's this FIPS 140-2 capability.
And a secure kernel.
Does no one else in the world of Android offer something like that? I mean, I'm not really super up to date on these heavily locked down Linux kernels and operating systems. Mm-hmm. I know there are a few projects out there, but nobody else in the world of Android has that?
I don't know of any that. Having said that, I didn't research that closely. This is obviously BlackBerry's obviously looking at some enterprise sales, most likely. And the way they describe the bootloader, it loads in steps, mm-hmm, and it always is verifying like the previous step. And so far, anyway, that's how they've been able to not get hacked.
And just so you know, Jacob, BlackBerry has quite a few apps on the iOS store as well. They have a Work Connect, BBM, BS 12 client, the Work Browser, BBS Enterprise. So
I remember it was a big deal a year or so ago when BBM came out. They were trying to really recapture that market because I know BlackBerry diehards were, you know, BBM was their world.
Right.
And they were trying to achieve that cross platform. Everybody will use BBM and we'll be a thing again, Jerry. and I think they were just a little bit too late. But I mean, you know, BlackBerry always made really decent hardware back in the days of, you know, dedicated BlackBerry hardware. I had a BlackBerry. I love the thing back before iPhones were a commonplace. Mm-hmm. So I did a quick wiki search, and it looks like FIPS stands for Federal Information Processing Standards. And then the 140-2 certifies all of the blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it talks about the fact that it boots in stages from, I guess, level 1 to level 4, and each stage is increasingly more secure than the level before it, and it uses all sorts of cryptographic stuff. So that's interesting. And I know that was a big deal when Obama was first elected, and I think he ultimately had to get a special government-branded locked-down BlackBerry to continue with. But I didn't realize that nobody else really had that.
Yeah, this phone's been out for a little while. It's priced at $500 unlocked, pretty reasonable. And the reviewer, Jerry Hildebrand, notes that the software flies even with the data encryption. So if you have an office that or a job that requires that, that would be good. Or if you loved all the BlackBerry services back in the day, you can get a brand new phone with some good specs that'll run it.
Huh. And this is interesting. I just did another quick Google search, and it looks like at least iOS 6, potentially iOS 7, are both granted FIPS 140-2 compliance as well.
Nice.
And I know Apple, that, you know, security is their big thing. So it would shock me that iOS 8, 9, and 10 are not, unless the validation process just takes forever. So yeah, it looks like there are some options. Yeah, it looks like at least modules in iOS 9 are validated. So, interesting.
Yeah, the other thing I had real quick was that Android Wear 2.0 is going to be announced on February 9th, and LG's got a couple of watches that they're going to announce at the same time. So, I'm definitely interested in the Watch Sport, which will have IP68 rating.
Oh, nice. I just saw a very short article the other day that caused a bit of a kerfuffle that somebody, and it may be LG with the proposed new watch, is apparently stealing Apple's digital crown, and the whole internet is, oh my God, how dare they steal a metaphor for a watch that's been around for 200 years? The outrage! And
They'll be lucky to sell 10% of Apple sales. I mean, that's crazy.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, smartwatches in general, I think, are a pretty small niche segment anywho. Very cool.
Yeah, so that's all I had for average Android this week.
But yeah, that's cool. I really want to know about that BlackBerry thing, because I thought they were pretty much dead and gone.
They sort of are, at least as a hardware company.
But yeah,
they're gonna still make the software and partner with somebody who knows how to make good phones on the cheap.
I didn't know. I mean, I assumed that they were pretty much all but done, except for those diehard companies that were still hanging on. I didn't know that they had pretty much abandoned all hardware, which it's a little bit of a shame. It's a shame they weren't able to stick it out and make a play. But
I'm going to keep an eye out too, because a 2560 by 1440 AMOLED display, I think that may be enough to be compatible with Daydream. Now, it hasn't been announced yet, so I don't know if I'll need the NuGet upgrade, but I'm interested to see if that phone gets
high enough resolution. You know,
yeah, high enough resolution, and I think the AMOLED display is one of the keys.
Very cool. All right, well, I think we're over an hour, so we'll talk about what we love and wrap it up and let everybody get back to work. Todd, what is it that you love?
All right, so this may be a repeat, but I'm going to give a shout out to Jeff for recommending the Shure 215 earbuds, and they're about $100 at Newegg or Amazon. Sorry, Jeff recommended these to me, and I think I mentioned that they just kind of sat in a drawer for a while, but I have used them recently, and they're wonderful. It's they're comfortable, stay in my ears, and they provide a good seal if I'm listening to podcasts in the office, and I do about all the listening in the office, then I will just have like one in one ear, so I can still hear things around me. But if somebody gets on a phone call, or if I want to listen to music, I'll put them in both, and it seals right up there and gives it really dampens the background noise. And they work great. They sound great. And as part of the pre-show, we were bantering about some things. And so the suggested music listening for you listeners is Motion City soundtrack, Her Words Destroyed My Planet. So give that a listen on the Shure 215 earbuds.
Very cool. I don't think you can go wrong with Shure anything. I mean, they're known for making just all around nice gear. I don't have a pair, but I'm envious of those of you that do. Not quite sure what I'm going to do for headphones yet. I want to do something.
Well, cool. I've only used them once, but I'll have something to say about the M-Pals that I bought too. But I wanted to use
the noise canceling ones, right? Yeah, I wanted to follow up on those. Definitely, you'll have to get back to us on those cheap noise canceling. How can you go wrong with that if it works? Very cool. So what I love, I picked up a book last week and just sat down and devoured it. It's not a hard read. It is called AWOL on the Appalachian Trail. It is a biography, autobiography, written by software engineer David Miller. It's his story of through hiking the Appalachian Trail in 2003. If you are an Amazon Prime member, Amazon has a program called... I think it's Amazon Prime Reading, which it is. It's free. It's included as part of the Prime membership, and you get access to certain books just included, and you can download them and read them to your heart's content. So you can pick it out. You can check it out on that and read it at no cost. But it is definitely worth checking out if you are passingly interested in hiking at all. He talks about his hike of the trail, all 2,172 miles of it that he did, and I think I want to say 137 or 147 days. And it was just fascinating. I kind of got into hiking a little bit at the end of last year. I definitely want to do more this year. I don't think anything nearly that ambitious, but it is nice to kind of be out in nature and do some hiking, and it's just really interesting. Apparently, since he wrote this book, he's become quite the expert on guidebooks and has written every year a pair of guidebooks for people who are through hiking starting on the southern terminus of the trail, hiking north, and for people who are starting on the northern terminus and hiking south. And apparently they are incredibly detailed what to look for, where to expect it, where to go see it, and all of that good stuff. So that's what I recommend. Check it out. AWOL on the Appalachian Trail. Jeff, what about you? What do you love?
So I'm going to throw out there, I had an external hard drive that I was keeping my iTunes library and all my photos on, and it started losing connection. Like every, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, ew, it would pop up and iTunes would come up and say, I can't find your library. I can't find your library.
That's never good.
And I'd have to unplug it, plug it back in. So I was like, you know what? I bet it's just the hard drive. I'm going to get something. And for $47, I picked up a Seagate expansion 1 terabyte. It's very tiny. I'm holding it up for them to see.
Yeah, a little 2.5-inch drive.
Yeah, it's a little 2.5-inch one. It's USB 3, very fast, small, and just works like a champ. Hadn't had any problems and love it. So if you're looking for a small 1 terabyte drive, check out the Seagate expansion.
I just can't based believe it off. They've gotten that cheap.
$48. Wow.
Yeah, it's so cheap. And it's like, yeah. So, yep, that's what I keep my iTunes library and my photos library on. And, you know, it's perfect just to carry around.
It looks like you caught a deal. It's up to $54.99 now on the Amazon.
Oh, my
gosh.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. At 48, I know, it was right? A deal. At 55, I don't know.
Well, keep your eyes open. Maybe you could catch it on a deal yourself. So that's what I love. Cool. So let's wrap things up by thanking our patrons, Dennis, Jamie, Jeffrey, Jimmy, John, and Kai. We appreciate your support. I guess that does it for another episode of the Know Better Than Average podcast. Now, hopefully you know better than average too. Goodbye, everybody.
Have a great week, everyone.
Talk at you later, everybody.